Sunday morning, coming down. On a cloudy day in late August, just before the start of my fourth year of college, I sat alone doing my daily afternoon bong tokes when someone knocked on my door. "Come on," I bellowed. This was my customary greeting. Looking back, it probably sounded more like "hold on," but at the time I was too burnt out to realize this or just about anything else. Most of my friends usually just walked in after a quick knock, so I was a bit tentative while I maneuvered through my hazy apartment towards the front door. Still, I didn't bother to hide the bong or the Tupperware container filled with crystal-coated buds. "I said come in," I muttered as I swung the door open. On the other side stood two Michigan State police troopers, both wearing matching looks of gloom. My initial paranoia turned to outright fear when the older of the two officers asked, "May I speak with Gabriel Waskowitz?" What had I done? Well, actually, what hadn't I done lately to warrant a visit from the cops? The last couple years of my life had consisted of one long series of drug-induced adventures. But what did they know about? Should I lie? Tell them, he's not here right now, and hope for the best? After glancing over my shoulder at the swirls of pot smoke glimmering in the patch of daylight the open door allowed into my otherwise dreary abode, I felt less than reassured. The marching hammers on the Pink Floyd the Wall poster hanging behind my TV set didn't help. "Yeah, that's me," I finally whimpered. "I've always been too dumb to lie." "You're the son of Michael Joseph Waskowitz?" "Yes, sir." "I'm sorry to have to inform you," the officer said while struggling to maintain eye contact, "but your father was found dead this morning." A few more questions passed between us. How did it happen? Where was he found? Is there anything else we can do for you? But the rest of that day has faded into the fog of my living room. At some point, I called my only sibling, my sister Catherine. I must have called my mom, too. I'm sure I did more bong tokes. I know I didn't cry. I first remember seeing my father when I was around 5 or 6. Faded Polaroids are evidence of previous encounters, but I have no recollection of the awkward moments that they capture of Catherine and me sitting on my father's lap. In each photo, he tried to maintain a smile. Despite the circumstances and the looks of terror on his children's faces, my father's bright blue eyes gleam in stark contrast to his white t-shirt and the cement walls in the background. Those moments of uncomfortable hugs and forced kisses are not what I recall most about this day either. My first experience with Chicken McNuggets on the way there, and my repeated attempts to get my stepdad to come inside linger instead. "But why do you want to come inside with us, Jim?" I pestered my stepdad in the waiting area, failing to fully comprehend the situation. My mother had remarried shortly before I turned 5, and with a male figure finally in my life, I wanted him to accompany me everywhere. "I just really don't like these kind of places," he said, gently trying to appease me. "It'll be okay. You go on in with your mom and sis, and I'll be right here waiting when you get back." "But why don't you like it here?" "I just don't like being frisked," he finally grumbled. Still not completely convinced, I continued pleading with him as a short, squat female guard patted me down and ushered me through a metal detector. I followed her, mesmerized by the huge ring of keys hanging at her side. They jangled like my mom's wind chimes as she led us through a series of locked doors and ushered us into the visitation area of the Marquette Maximum Security Prison. One rainy summer afternoon a couple of years later, I discovered several handwritten pages tucked away in a dusty Bible on my mom's bookshelf. At first, I half-skimmed the writing before realizing what it contained. I became mesmerized, not really wanting to read these words to know what my dad had done to my mom, but I was unable to stop. This letter was my mom's account of the night my dad nearly killed her, written as a form of therapy. Before finding it, I knew little about my father's imprisonment, only that he had somehow hurt my mother. The letter vividly described how in the midst of a Vietnam flashback, he repeatedly choked her to the point of passing out. While I cried in my crib at 9 months old, my father was out of his mind trying to strangle my mom. Upon regaining consciousness, she tried pleading with him to let her check on the baby, to which he responded, "I'll take care of him when I'm finished with you." Eventually, my mom managed to escape outside long enough to alert the neighbors to call the police, before being dragged back inside. I placed the letter back in the Bible as raindrops trickled down our living room window. I never talked about the letter, or what it contained, with anyone. Only years later did my mom explain to me more about what happened that night. My father had once again started to slowly lose his grip on reality. He had been attending Alcoholics Anonymous and claimed that they had told him to stop taking the medications prescribed to him for the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder because he was using them as a substitute for alcohol. He became increasingly angry and paranoid. He thought the meter reader for the electric company was at the house because my mother was having an affair with him. He accused her of trying to poison his food. Everything became her fault. Unable to cope without his medication, my father eventually lost control completely. Earlier that day, his best friend since childhood, Mark, came to the house with the hopes of getting my mom to go and stay with his wife and him for a while. Being a Vietnam vet too, Mark understood some of what my father was experiencing. My mom told Mark that she'd married my father for better or for worse. He was sentenced to serve 3 to 10 years for intent to do great bodily harm. My mom filed for divorce and brought me and my sister back to live in the small northern Michigan town where she had grown up. At 19, my father volunteered for the Army, assuming he would be drafted and sent to Vietnam anyway. He always kept his experiences there private, telling me only that they weren't women and baby killers, and to believe parts of Full Metal Jacket and the Deer Hunter more than Apocalypse Now. From what I've been told, on his 25th birthday, which fell on or near Mother's Day, he watched his whole platoon die around him. Somehow he survived untouched, at least physically. He suffered a complete nervous breakdown. After a medevac flew him out of the jungle, my father was sent back to the States, first to a veterans hospital in San Diego, and then to another hospital in his home state of Michigan. These would be the first in a series of VA hospitalizations that would plague him for the rest of his life. While I was growing up, he often asked me, "Is it better to live a coward or die a hero?" I would not be here had he died a hero. Maybe he would not have suffered for the remainder of his life if he had not thought of himself as a coward. Once my father was released from prison, he made an effort to make up for the years he had missed. My first memory of seeing him outside of the penitentiary was in a cafe called the Night Owl in my hometown. As we sat in a booth eating breakfast with my maternal grandmother, I couldn't help but gawk at this loud, socially awkward creature sitting across from me. He'd holler for the waitress to bring him more coffee between bites of overly peppered eggs. His booming voice carried throughout the small restaurant, drawing looks from other customers. Looking back, the small-town rumors about who he was and where he'd just gotten out of probably had as much to do with the odd looks he received as his eccentric behavior did. But a child of 8 fails to draw such conclusions. As we ate, he asked me questions about what I wanted to be when I grew up and what I was learning in school. I did my best to answer him, but could only squeak out a few half-hearted responses as I scooted closer to my grandma. Later, when he got up to use the bathroom, I asked my grandma, "Is this really my real dad?" He had just bought me every G.I. Joe guy I wanted in the Ben Franklin next door, but I was having trouble accepting that the man everyone seemed to be staring at could in any way be responsible for me. He seemed so foreign to the world I was accustomed to. All my grandma could do was sigh and slowly nod her head. I would continue to be embarrassed by my father throughout my adolescence. In fact, for the remainder of his life, I felt varying degrees of discomfort when dealing with my father in public. Some of this embarrassment was caused by his drinking. Preferring brandy and blads over prescription medication, he'd tell me that every town needs a drunk. Having never experienced any form of alcoholism when I was younger, trying to understand and cope with this for my father was difficult. Being on 100% disability from the military, he wasn't your typical town drunk, waking up in gutters and begging for change. He had enough money to support himself, but maintained the life of a daily alcoholic, spending many lonely hours deep inside a bottle. Accepting him for who he was would take me many years. As these years went by, my father spent less time in the city of Saginaw where he grew up, and more time in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, just to be close to my sister and me. It began as visits for a few days or a week, time he'd spend in his hotel room watching old films like Dr. Zhivago. My mom, who always wanted her children to know their father, eventually allowed him to visit us at her home in the country. On one such visit, I was outside playing with my father and a foster child who lived with my family when a helicopter approached. Whatever game we were playing ceased to have meaning as my father crouched down in the tall weeds, imploring us to do the same. As I tried to explain that the other boy's name was Ronnie, not Charlie, my father became increasingly frantic. Once the hiss of the propeller faded into the distance, he slowly started to regain his composure. Ronnie and I couldn't understand why he didn't want to stay outside and play anymore. These short stays eventually led to him renting a cabin for the summer. Then he rented an apartment for a year, about an hour away, just on the other side of the Wisconsin border. Finally, for a majority of my last couple years of high school, he lived in or around my hometown. During this ever-increasing time spent with him, I learned more about the person he was and who he could have been. When I was old enough to drive, I'd usually stop in for a visit a couple times a week. He'd cook me a steak and ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up. We'd watch a baseball game, and he'd tell me he would have enjoyed watching me play Little League more than these overpriced bastards on TV. One night I was just getting ready to leave, to go drink some beers with friends most likely, when the John Malkovich version of Mice and Men came on TV. When I explained to him that I'd read The Grapes of Wrath in school instead, and by read, I mean mostly slept through the movie, he refused to let me leave. Usually when I wanted to go, he tried to get me to stay a little longer, but that night he basically forced me to stay. The memory of watching the tale of George and Lenny that night with my father is far better than whatever drunken adventures I would have gotten into with my buddies. In the same one-bedroom home where he first introduced me to the power of Steinbeck, we also pondered the fate of the world as we watched O.J. fleeing in his white Bronco. It was the day after my 18th birthday. Another time, I sat in awe as he answered nearly every question in an episode of Jeopardy correctly through a mouthful of spaghetti, chunks of noodles flying at Alex Trebek's face on the TV screen. We even got a chance to drink a few beers together some nights the summer after my senior year, and he would give me advice like, never trust a man who won't have a drink with you. I didn't realize then that I was a lot more like him than I would ever care to admit. I began to understand that despite all his imperfections, he cared more about Catherine and me than anything. When he was around my friends, I was still mortified at what he might say or do. I never got to the point where I felt completely comfortable with him around other people. If it was just the two of us, I accepted him for who he was, but around others, I was still somewhat ashamed that he was my father. Still, it was during these years that I started to consider him more than just a father. He was my dad. This process never fully blossomed, however. He would die before I could ever fully come to appreciate him. The frequent conclusions to most of his visits or stays in the UP was often a trip to the VA hospital. Ever since Vietnam, he suffered from bouts of mental illness. Diagnosed as both schizophrenic and bipolar, he functioned normally for long stretches of time, only to inevitably lose touch once again. While in the hospital, he would call regularly, feeding quarters into a payphone just to hear his kids' voices. Long letters would arrive in the mail nearly every other day. They were often hard to read because his already scribbled handwriting became nearly illegible from over-medication. I still have one of the last letters he sent me. In it, he candidly describes how he blamed himself more than circumstance for the events of his life. Also included are regrets about not being around when I was little, the usual demand that I never join the military, a recommendation of Hemingway and Steinbeck because they knew the score, and most of the lyrics to Johnny Cash's Sunday Morning Coming Down. In the song, Cash begins, "Well, I woke up Sunday morning with no way to hold my head that didn't hurt, and the beer I had for breakfast wasn't bad, so I had one more for dessert. Then I fumbled in my closet, through my clothes to find my cleanest dirty shirt." My dad acknowledged that these words were not his own, but he felt that they probably best described his life. The chorus ends with the line, "And it took me back to something that I'd lost somewhere, somehow, along the way." The last time I saw my dad alive was at my cousin Rachel's wedding. He looked good, thinner than I'd seen him in years. He looked so happy as he danced with my sister, slowly swaying to the music. After dinner and a couple of beers, he left early, having said goodbye to everyone. Only 2 weeks later, he was found in a bed at a Super 8 near Saginaw by the maid. Gastrointestinal hemorrhage, a common problem with alcoholics. The warning signs of internal bleeding ignored, he basically bled to death internally. My dad was 49. The tears that didn't come the day I found out he died also didn't come at his funeral. Instead, I remained stoic as Mark, his childhood friend, looked into the casket and said, "Mike's finally come home from Vietnam." Like many men from his generation, my father could never put the horrors of the war behind him. What happened to him there came to define the rest of his life. When he died, I don't think I knew how to feel about my father yet. I feared being like him for so long that I wasn't prepared to properly let him go. Now, a decade and a half later, I've accepted him for who he was, a kind, compassionate man, flawed like everyone else, some of which was his own doing, and some of which was not. In the years since his death, I've had my own struggles with drugs and alcohol, battled bouts of mental illness, and through it all, learned that being like your father isn't always the worst thing in the world. A year after his death, I went to his grave with a six-pack of Heineken and started the path towards acceptance. As I sat and shared those beers with my dad, I told him all the things I was too immature to say when he was alive. Things like, "I forgive you for everything. I wish I understood you more when you were alive. I know you loved my mom until the day you died. And I know your suffering is finally over." Maybe these are the things I said then, Or maybe they're just the things I think of now that I wish I had said sooner.